Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, skywatching the Pleiades star cluster. Song of the week is by Echocentrix, and we'll speak with a U.S. geophysicist about the activity of the Cleveland volcano up in Alaska. Here's your scientist soundbite.
The midnight culmination of the Pleiades is on November 20th. So the midnight culmination means that the Pleiades is at its highest in the sky at midnight. And in this case, by midnight, what we mean is the time midway between sunset and sunrise. So in other words, the Pleiades is up all night long on November 20th.
That's skywatching expert Deborah Bird. We'll speak with her later. But first, Emily Howard and I are going to run through science news of the week. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks, Mike. In the last few years, scientists have made great inroads in understanding the crucial interactive role that gut bacteria play in harvesting nutrients, assisting immune systems, and protecting the host against pathogens. Now, Yale University researchers have discovered that humans and chimpanzees, our closest evolutionary relatives, share the same three distinct communities or ecosystems of bacteria in their guts. This study appears in the November 13th issue of the journal Nature Communications.
Astronomers using ESO's Very Large Telescope and the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope have identified a body that is most likely a planet wandering through space without a parent star. This is the most exciting free-floating planet candidate so far, and the closest such object to the solar system at a distance of about 100 light years.
Snowball Earth is a theory suggesting that, more than 650 million years ago, for up to millions of years at a time, Earth was entirely smothered in ice. There is geological evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists have not been able to agree on how a highly reflective, ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again. On November 13th, the American Geophysical Union announced a study casting some new light on this theory. Scientists studied the heat-trapping potential of clouds above an ice-covered world, which they now say could help explain how a snowball Earth thawed. More at earthsky.org.
With above-average temperatures occurring throughout the past 16 months across the contiguous United States, October 2012 halted this streak with slightly below-average temperatures across the country. In fact, according to the National Climatic Data Center, October 2012 averaged at 53.9 degrees Fahrenheit, or roughly 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit below the long-term average. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
I'm Emily Howard.
Thanks, Emily.
My pleasure.
Song of the Week is Down Under by the Echocentrix. It's off their album, Sun Shadows.
Try to get rid of the space.
You're listening to Earth Sky 22. You can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about something to look for in the night sky, the Pleiades star cluster. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. The Pleiades, yeah, they're also known as the Seven Sisters. So people know them by a variety of names, in fact, because they're one of the most noticeable sky objects.
Yeah, I understand that some people mistake it for the Little Dipper.
That's right, because it looks like a dipper, but it's a very, very, very tiny dipper. So if you go outside tonight, say, you know, mid-evening to late evening, no matter where you are on Earth, and look up and look for a little bitty dipper in the sky, that'll probably be the Pleiades. It's a very noticeable little object.
Okay, great. So it looks like a faint star cluster to us, but what really is the Pleiades?
Well, the Pleiades actually is a cluster of stars in space. So let's talk a minute about how stars are born. Stars in our Milky Way galaxy, and presumably in other galaxies too, if the physics as we know it holds true across the universe, which we believe it does, are born from clouds of gas and dust in space. So what happens is that the pockets within the clouds start to collapse, and those places that are collapsing spin faster and faster and faster and faster, and you know they collapse more and more and more, and ultimately they collapse enough that they get hot enough inside that thermonuclear fusion begins inside these objects, and at that point they become stars. So the Pleiades is a place where there was a cloud in space, but now hundreds of stars have collapsed out of this cloud. So the Pleiades is what's known as an open star cluster. There are thought to be maybe tens of thousands of open star clusters at any given time in the Milky Way galaxy, and the Pleiades is a particularly bright and noticeable one that you can see with just your eye.
Wow. So do we know how many stars are in the cluster?
Well, they're thought to be a couple of hundred stars. So one thing that's interesting about these open star clusters, I mean, a question that you might be asking yourself is, well, why don't we see more of them? I mean, if stars are born in this way, why don't we just see open star clusters everywhere?
Right.
And the answer is that once they're in these clusters, once the stars are there, they're moving through the space of the galaxy, and the stars in the cluster are interacting with each other. Sometimes they're kind of coming close to each other, and they can push each other out of the cluster. Their gravity will interact and they can just expel each other from the cluster. So pretty quickly what happens is that these clusters disperse. And in fact, our own sun is thought to have been born from a cluster such as this one. There's some nearby stars that astronomers have identified that might have been part of the open star cluster that the sun was born from. For example, the nearest star to Earth, Alpha Centauri, was probably born from the same cloud of gas as the sun. And some of you know the star Barnard Star. That's another nearby star thought to have been born, you know, in the same nebula or cloud as the sun, and thought to have once upon a time been in an open star cluster with our sun, now dispersed.
Wow. So, Deborah, can you tell us a little bit more about how to see the Pleiades star cluster?
Well, as I said, it looks like a Little Dipper, and people do mistake it for the actual Little Dipper. People ask that question all the time. The real Little Dipper asterism, that's the famous one, is in the northern sky. The Pleiades is more along the path that the sun and moon travel across the sky, and in fact, the moon is sometimes close to the Pleiades, and so that will sometimes make it easy to see. But it's really better to see it when the moon's not there, because it's, you know, you get a better view of it. And you don't need the moon to find it, because you just want to look up, look along the path that the sun and moon travel across the sky, look somewhere along that path for a tiny, misty-looking, dipper-shaped object. And again, they're sometimes called the Seven Sisters, but if you look with just your eye, you'll probably only see six stars in the Pleiades. And so a lot of Greek myths and so on ask the question of what happened to that seventh sister in the Pleiades.
What happened to her?
I don't know. I'm not sure. You have to ask the Greek mythologists about that one. There's a lot of different stories. But the cool thing is that if you took an ordinary pair of binoculars, you could see several dozen stars in the Pleiades. And if you took a telescope, you could see even more, possibly several hundred stars.
So we're presumably talking about this right now because it's a good time to see the Pleiades, right?
That's right. The midnight culmination of the Pleiades is on November 20th. So the midnight culmination means that the Pleiades is at its highest in the sky at midnight. And in this case, by midnight, what we mean is the time midway between sunset and sunrise. So in other words, the Pleiades is up all night long on November 20th. And in fact, we associate this star cluster with the season of autumn and also winter. It's very visible in the winter sky as well. Of course, in the southern hemisphere right now, you can also see the Pleiades, but people in the southern hemisphere associate it with spring and summer. In fact, in South Africa, the Pleiades are called the hoeing stars.
Okay. They're breaking ground down there.
That's right.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Deborah.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Here's Roll the Bones by Shaky Graves. Thank you. Cleveland, otherwise known as Cleveland Volcano, is a remote and uninhabited island in the Aleutian Island chain extending from Alaska. Scientists keep an eye on this volcano because when it spews out ash, it can create a hazard for aircraft. On November 10th, Earth orbiting satellites detected a small ash cloud from Mount Cleveland. On the line to talk about it is USGS geophysicist Rick Wessels. Dr. Wessels, welcome to Earth Sky 22.
It's my pleasure.
So Mount Cleveland has been upgraded to a level orange alert. Can you explain to our listeners what that means and how it's being monitored?
Well, right now, Cleveland volcano is at orange based on when via satellite, we detected an ash cloud that came out of it on Saturday around noon in Alaska. And really, the only way we monitor that particular volcano is via satellite, and we also have infrasound stations that are within a few hundred miles of it that can detect explosions, although that's several minutes after the fact. So right now, we technically say Cleveland volcano is an unmonitored volcano because we don't have any of our own instruments on it like we do for 30 other volcanoes in the state.
What's the danger of ash from a volcano like Cleveland?
Yeah, the main danger from ash is for aviation. The North Pacific is actually full of a whole bunch of major jet routes between North America and the Far East. And so ash, when it reaches up to the flight altitudes that these jets fly at, is actually pretty bad for jet engines. And at least historically, there's been jets that have flown through ash and it's stalled all the engines. Luckily, since we've been doing this, that kind of thing hasn't happened in many decades. But the aviation hazard's the main thing we're trying to avoid.
Has anything changed in the last week since this was upgraded to orange?
No, we haven't had any nice, clear satellite views since that time, and so we're kind of waiting for a couple of clear views so we can confirm what's going on at the volcano. And once we get that, the most likely scenario is it'll go back down to yellow based on what we've done in the past. But there is a chance that, when we get our next view, maybe we'll spot a new lava dome or something, which would indicate that it's still erupting. And then in that case, we would probably stay at orange.
I recently read about scientists studying ground deformation prior to an eruption. Mm-hmm. Can you explain this technique, and will scientists be able to forecast eruptions using this technology?
It's become a fairly useful tool. It's from synthetic aperture radar interferometry, and so there's a lot of different satellites up there launched by various countries and commercial companies that can do detailed radar imaging of a volcanic area, and then if you repeat that imaging with a second or third image, you can look for really small changes in the surface as far as did the surface move towards the satellite or away from the satellite. We can do that down to a centimeter or less resolution change. And so SAR interferometry has been a big, or we call it NSAR for short, has been a major new tool for earthquake deformation as well as volcano deformation, landslides, land subsidence due to water pumping, because it can pick up pretty small changes over big areas. And for us, it's great for Alaska because we don't have the ability to put a lot of instruments out on all of our volcanoes. And so we have several USGS scientists and scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks that use different kinds of radar data to sort of watch our volcanoes breathe, basically, as things inflate and deflate. And sometimes that breathing will help lead you towards forecasting an eruption, but they're deforming all the time. When we first started SAR interferometry, people got alarmed. They saw, wow, look at how much these things are moving. But with a lot of the volcanoes, now that we have 15, 20 years of these data, you see all these things just kind of breathe like this, a lot of them do. And so when they deflect from that pattern or the change happens more rapidly or in a much higher scale, that's when you start thinking about an eruption.
So I hope you guys get some clear skies so you can get a good shot of Cleveland.
Yeah, we've got pretty much every satellite we can point at it looking for that one cloud-free shot. So hopefully we'll get one soon.
Dr. Wessels, thanks for speaking with us.
No, it's my pleasure.
That was geophysicist Rick Wessels with the USGS. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded in Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas. Live music capital of the world. Special thanks to our musical contributors. For more on the music or the science you heard, visit earthsky.org. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.